I'm Beth Golay, and this is Marginalia. In his new book, The Ferryman and His Wife, Norwegian author Frode Grytten imagines the last day in the life of a ferryman named Nils. Nils is joined on his final boat ride by his previously deceased dog, Luna, and along the way he meets former passengers he's transported who also have since passed. But the person Nils most wants to reunite with is his late wife, Marta. I recently spoke with Frode Grytten, who wrote the book in one of the two official Norwegian languages, as well as his English translator, Allison McCullough. Here's our conversation. So I've visited with authors and I've visited with translators, but I have never had both in a conversation with me at the same time. So I will have a few questions about craft and the translation process. But first, can you give our listeners a description of The Ferryman and His Wife?
Yeah, it's a simple story about the man, the last day in his life. So he wakes up and he knows that he's going to die, I think. He's tidying up his house and then he goes to his boat and at one moment, he discovers that his dog is joining him, and his dog has been dead for maybe 20 years. So that's an omen. And he goes down to his boat. He's a ferryman and starts the journey, the last day of his life. And at this journey, he meets a lot of the people that he has met through his life and talk to them and make a last conversation with them. And of course, finally, he wants to meet his dead wife. So it's a simple story, but it's a complicated story because it contains all his life and all his stories.
Yeah, as he steers his boat, he encounters through memory or through his journals or logs, people he's transported on the ferry and who have died, all who have touched him in some way or another. Where did this idea begin for you?
It began with my maternal grandfather because he was a ferryman in Hardangerfjord in Norway and West Coast. So I joined him as a child, but he was very private. He was not talkative. So I knew not that much about him. But before he died, he did some interviews with the local papers. So I read them. And at one point, I wrote a little poem about him. And that poem, grew and became a novel. It was my maternal grandfather, but since I knew so little about him, I had to invent this character. So it became the man called Nils Vik.
Can we talk about the fjord for a moment? Because it's almost a character in the book itself, isn't it?
Yeah, I grew up in the bottom of a fjord. That's the Hardanger Fjord. And when you're a child, you don't think so much about it because it's your hometown and it's your the place you're used to be. And but as I grew older and moved away, and I moved away to Bergen, which is the second largest city in Norway. And when I came back to visit my parents and do stuff in my hometown, it struck me this is a really strange place with the high mountains and the fjord. And I can see why tourists come to Hardanger and my hometown, because it's really beautiful and it's wild and it's raw. And the fjord, it's at some point, it was the only road, in a way, the road on the water to get away from this town or get in there. So I agree with you. It's kind of a character in the novel, and it's a really special place, and it's really wild and it's harsh and it's tough living at the fjord because it's so steep, and but it's also able to produce watercraft and power, and that was the reason that we moved to Odda, where it's for 120 years ago, they started a plant industry and because of the water power.
So you mentioned Luna, the dog. It was one of the first characters that had passed that Nils encounters. And Luna kind of acts as a guide almost, easing him on his own journey to the afterlife. Why did you choose the dog for this role?
I'm not sure. It came natural because it's a lonely life, I think, for Nils to be on the fjord because he's mostly on his own. But of course, he has his passengers and all that people come in and he's ferrying them over the fjord and back and so on. But I think half of the time he's alone. So he has to talk to someone. And that's natural to be talking to your dog. I don't have a dog. I have a cat and I talk with my cat. So I think it's it's not unnatural to do that. So he wants to, of course, he's talking to himself, of course. And the reader knows that because it's a special relationship in a way.
So each memory of someone who rode the ferry, these were linked stories in a way. Do you have a favorite of one of these stories from the book?
I'm not sure. Maybe one of the first guys that he meets is the guitar player, the young boy. He's just maybe 18 or 19 when he dies. And he's kind of a rebel and he wants to have long hair and wants to play the guitar. And Nils, the ferryman, he understands his boy in a way that his parents don't understand. So it's a kind of fine relationship between those the young boy and this more mature and grown man.
I noticed a couple of things that kept recurring. The Vietnam War. Can you talk to me about the importance of that to this book?
If you live in the fjord, as I mentioned earlier, it's kind of isolated with the water and the nature and the mountains. But I wanted to have the world seep into that fjord, and the perspective of they're not isolated, they're part of the world, and that becomes more and more clear for Nils Vik as the years go, and that world seeping into the fjord also makes him out of work because his trade is being on the fjord with his boat, and then there are roads coming and a bridge is coming, and that makes him out of work. He's not able to live as a ferryman anymore. I wanted the world to be a part of the community, the local place also.
Well, you know, I was thinking about that bridge because, you know, it was being built and it was taking work away from the ferryman. But Nils was the ferryman who loves the bridge all the same. That's a quote from the book.
Yeah, I think that is a beautiful thing about him because he's not conservative, that he wants everything to be as it always has been. He wants to move on. He wants to be part of the society that moves on. And surely when he passes this bridge that takes him out of work and makes him not an important person in the community anymore, he can see the beauty in this bridge. He can see the lights and the way it's constructed and all the work that goes into making this bridge. And I think that makes him a man of substance in a way, that he's able to see progress, he's able to see things change in life and also in his small community. Some things are good and some things are bad. It's bad for him as he is not able to earn any money anymore. But for people, it's good that they're able to connect in other ways.
One passage that stuck with me, I'm wondering if you can comment on it after I read it. A ferryman is a constant variation, reliable and to be trusted absolutely. He comes when he says he will. He floods into the fjord and ebbs out of the fjord, just like the water that crashes and pools, that accepts and embraces all things, but always onward, onward, like the hands of the watch on his wrist, in the direction of those already moving at speed, making headway. Soon he will turn off the motor and all that momentum will be lost.
Yeah, that's beautiful written. he's a reliable man, and you can trust him, and that was important in art and in movies and novels. there's so many crooks, so many bad people, and I want to write about a good man, a reliable man. And he lives near nature. He lives with nature, and he's kind of nature himself. So that's the thing of the nature, with the ebbs and flows and the water and the seasons. It's part of him. So he's reliable, and you can trust him, and he comes when he has to come, and he does his work. So I like this guy. He's a good man.
I like this guy too. So I've read some sentences back to you, and they're your words, but they're also Allison's words, aren't they? Can you, Allison, talk to me about the choices you have to make while translating? Is there more than one way to say the ferryman who loves the bridge all the same? Are you trying to match tone or match lyricism? Talk to me about how you have to translate.
Absolutely. And of course, translation is always a matter of a million different decisions and competing priorities, what we're trying to emphasize. And what I always think about when translating any text, and especially important to me with translating Froda's book, because I connected so deeply with it, was to try to give the reader the same experience of Froda's book that I had reading it myself. There are two official written versions of the Norwegian language. There is Bokmål and there is Nynorsk, or New Norwegian. And Froda writes in Nynorsk, which is the lesser used of the two versions. And I love translating from Nynorsk. I love the challenges it poses, because it's quite a, or it feels to me, quite a compressed, quite concise language. But it's also very expansive. You can say so much with so few words, in a way. And so what I really focused on was maintaining the musicality, the rhythm, the sense of Froda's writing being so precise. And so, you know, I translated, and then really it was a case of honing it down, honing it down, honing it down, making sure I'd got the rhythms exactly right, as close as I could. Because of course you can never just present someone with the original. There is no one way to translate a text. So this was my best way of, yeah, trying to give the reader the experience of reading this work, which I love so much.
Maybe I should have started with this. How does the translation process work? Is there collaboration between the two of you, or how does it work?
Not sort of in the sense of, I started the translation. Obviously, I did the first draft myself, and then Froda was able to read through afterwards and give any comments on anything that didn't feel quite right. But first, for me, it's always important that I feel that I have a sense of the voice in English myself, because often I'll start translating a work and I will be translating along, and then there will be a moment where I can feel it, where something will click and I will think, ah, I have the voice now. I have it. You know, often that happens when I'm going through again and sort of editing, and I will feel the moment where the flow is right, the musicality feels right to me. And then after that, if there are things that are, you know, there's a double meaning, for example, and I'm wondering which one of these to prioritize. Sometimes there are things that are a little difficult. For example, Jon, the boy with the guitar who Froda mentioned earlier, the gender of his lover is never actually fully revealed in the book, because in Norwegian, you don't have to specify a male or a female or another gender. So it's a neutral gender. And so we had, it took quite a lot of work to work around that in a way that would reflect the Norwegian in the best possible way, even though it wasn't necessarily, I know Froda, we discussed it and it wasn't such an important question for Froda, but it felt important to me to reflect the Norwegian as best as possible within the bounds of what is possible in English.
Does it help that Froda speaks English very well? I mean, is that a plus in this case?
Yeah, absolutely, because he can obviously understand and comment on my work and what I've done. So yeah, that is always very useful. I mean, I don't know how it is for you, Froda, when you work with translators who are translating into completely different languages.
It was funny to read your translation, because then I was able to be a reader and not the writer. Usually when I read my own work in Norwegian, I'm the author, and I've been through the process of writing it and writing so many times that doesn't say anything to me at all because I'm the author. But when I read your translation, it was like I was becoming a reader because there was this, what you call it, like some distance between the text and me. And I was able to see it in a way as a reader. And that was very interesting for me. But I feel my English is so bad. I'm not able to write and talk in English, but I try. And it was fun reading. From my humble experience, it was a beautiful translation. And it takes the rhythm and the musicality in the language, and it preserves it in a very good way. So I was really happy with that. But in of course, if it's translated into Finnish or Chinese, I'm not able to. When you get the Chinese translation, you're not even sure, is this my work? It's just those strange Chinese letters.
Allison, what's the biggest challenge in translating a work like this?
Ooh, the first thing that comes to mind is it can feel like a very big responsibility. Wanting to do the text justice is one thing when you really admire a work so much, as I did with this one. But also things like, I mean, I've spoken already about maintaining the conciseness of the language. English feels like a much more wordy language to me, so really honing things down, finding that precision, but also really the voices of the characters too, I suppose, because in some ways this is a novel about, a very specific community, a specific class of people who live in a very specific area, and the patterns of their speech. I actually drew quite a lot on my own background. I'm from an industrial working class area in the north of England. And of course, it wouldn't be right to use a very specific British English or American English dialect, but just certain patterns of speech that felt right to me in translating some of the dialogue, for example. And again, maintaining that brevity was quite challenging. But it was just a joy to work on. I mean, I enjoyed it so much. None of it felt like hard work because it was just such a pleasure.
Froda, do you have a hope for what readers will take away from this book?
I think when you've written it and it's published, the readers find what they find. I don't have the answers to the mysteries of the novel, so I got a lot of feedbacks on the from the readers and also in people starting to read it in the US and in the UK, and it's interesting because they have different things that they are interested in, and but. As the author, I think my work is over when I've written the last sentence. So I'm not able to say that this is right or this is wrong, this is how you should read it. I hope that they get a sense of a man and a woman that's really loving each other, that this Nils and Martha, his beloved wife, I hope that. This is the important part of the novel, and people kind of get into that part of the story.
Well, the book is The Ferryman and His Wife, Froda Grytten and translator Allison McCullough. Thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Ferryman and His Wife by Froda Grytten was published by Algonquin Books. Joining us now from the Norwich Bookstore in Norwich, Vermont, are the store's owners, Emma and Sam Koss. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
So what books do you have for us today?
Oh, so many books. They keep coming, and we keep reading them. I'll tell you what, A book that I have just been enjoying the heck out of for the past couple of days is called The Gales of November by John U. Bacon. It's the story of the sinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald. We're coming up on the 50th anniversary of this tragedy, which, of course, many of us know from the Gordon Lightfoot song. And if you grew up in the Midwest, the Great Lakes area, this is sort of legendary. And this book was really fascinating. I'm actually in the middle of it. I'm listening to it, which is a treat. I don't often listen to audiobooks, but this has been a really, really fascinating one to consume that way. The story is really compelling. The science and the history behind the Great Lakes freighters and Great Lakes shipping and just the enormity of the Great Lakes, which is not something that I, as a person not from that area, is super familiar with. It's all fantastic. And anyone who listens to audiobooks knows that the narrator makes or breaks it. And the narrator for this sounds like a guy who you might encounter at the back of like a naval salvage shop somewhere on the coast of Maine, and you're not sure if he works there or not, or if he just hangs out. He's got that voice that just it feels steeped in maritime lore. So it's just been a real treat to listen to this book, and I just find it really, really interesting. You know, it comes close to the fascination that I had reading The Perfect Storm for the first time. So I'm looking forward to recommending it to folks.
Very cool. What about you, Emma?
For something completely different, except that I did listen to it on audio, a book called Ocean's Good Dory by Elaine Yu Cho is this awesome sci-fi novel, kind of like a space opera sci-fi. Full disclosure, I am friends with the author. She and I used to work together at Elliott Bay Book Company in Seattle, Washington, and we just had the absolute honor of hosting her and a number of other sci-fi fantasy authors at the store. It's actually a duology, this book. So her second book is called Teo's Durumi, and I haven't read the second one yet because I'm waiting for the audiobook because I just loved listening to Ocean's Good Dory so much. And just a really interesting, focused on this young woman who doesn't quite fit in, got in trouble with her last crew, and is kind of, it's her last chance. And she stumbles upon what I think is going to be a fairly like epic kind of cloak and dagger. There's a guy who is able to impersonate other people and has basically made it look like a friend of hers has murdered his entire family. And apparently, she wrote this book all as one book and then split it up when it came to publication. So it ends on a real cliffhanger. So you can tell that's how much I love the audiobook that I'm willing to wait.
That sounds fantastic. Okay, I'm sure you have other recommendations for us. What do you have?
Well, you know, another thing that I don't do very often, like listening to audiobooks, is I don't read a lot of sci-fi or fantasy. It's never been my thing. Emma generally is the sci-fi fantasy reader amongst us, as you just heard, but I actually have been reading a fantasy novel recently, and I've been really enjoying it. It is called Jade City. It's by Fonda Lee. It's not a brand new book, but it just got re-released with a really cool new cover. And the way I've been pitching this is it's kind of a sultry mafia thriller set on an island nation that reminds me a lot of like maybe Hong Kong, like a small international trade port that is also an island with a lot of ancient history, families who have been in this place for a long, long time. And now we're in some kind of like relatively near modern day. The internet doesn't get mentioned, but people have cool cars and that phones work and things like that. And the magical conceit in this world is that jade, the stone, has magical powers. If you're able to control it and touch it, which not everybody is, but if you are, if you're able to kind of enhance yourself mentally, physically, or you're going to be faster, or you're going to be able to perceive things around you. And so, of course, the people who have jade have a lot of power, and predictably, the people who don't would really like some of that power. So this is kind of it's sort of a saga of political intrigue following a family that is a long time legitimate political family in this community, and also maybe does like a little mafia on the side. And it has been really an enjoyable read so far. And there are two others in the series, so if that sounds up anybody's alley, I would urge you not only to seek out Jade City with the cool new cover, but also its sequels.
Very good. How about you, Emma? Do you have something else for us?
I have another fantasy recommendation. So I recently read The Incandescent by Emily Tesh, which I have been pitching as if Professor McGonagall was the main character of a book. It is a very odd combination of like bureaucracy and scheduling and manage like teacher management. And also there are like demon slayings, which is just so up my alley because I love getting organized, but I also love reading about some demon slaying. So it follows this woman who is not the principal of a school, but kind of high-ranking teacher in the school. And she has a tattoo on her arm that is actually a trapped demon. And some terrible things are happening at the school. The students are in trouble. I don't want to reveal too much because there was kind of a twist in the middle that I really didn't see coming. But the villain that you think is not necessarily the person that we're actually fighting against, but just really wonderful kind of dark academia fantasy.
Those are fantastic. Do you have any more for us?
I'll throw out one that came out a little earlier this year and did get some great buzz at the time, but I'll bring it back up to the surface because I think it was a great, great book. And that is the great Jess Walters' new novel, So Far Gone. I'm from the Pacific Northwest originally, so I've been following Jess for many years. I've loved many of his books and really enjoyed following his trajectory. But I think that So Far Gone is his best book in a while. It's a novel. It's relatively slim in the world of novels that have been coming out recently. I think it clocks in somewhere around 250 pages, if I'm not mistaken. It tells the story of a cranky former journalist who, after a particularly fraught Thanksgiving with his daughter and her kind of conspiracy theorist partner, decides that he just is not fit for society anymore, can't handle what's going on, can't handle the divisions, the conspiracies, and he throws away his phone. He heads out to his family's ancestral property in eastern Washington state, and he stays there for several years, living off the land until one day his grandchildren appear at the door and they have a problem, which is that their mom has gone missing. And the only person who can help out find his missing daughter and maybe set things right with his family is, of course, our cranky, secluded hero. This is a very of-the-moment novel. It's a very timely novel, and it touches on a lot of things that, people all over the place have been struggling to comprehend and being challenged by. And it could really be easy for a novel like this to become a real downer. But this one actually isn't. It ends on an incredibly hopeful note, to my reading at least. It feels satisfying. It feels fresh. It feels like it charts a path forward for all of us. And of course, because it's Jess Walter, it's also very funny, very poignant, very wry. So I enjoyed the heck out of it. So Far Gone, and highly recommend that folks pick it up.
Well, these sound like fantastic book recommendations. We'll have a list of all of the books that Emma and Sam have given us in our show notes. And there will also be a link, an audio link, to our extended conversation because we could not fit all of the recommendations in this show. So from Norwich Bookstore in Norwich, Vermont, Emma and Sam Koss, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Beth.
Thank you for having us.
Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR network. Our editors and producers for this week's show are Haley Krausen and Lou Ann Stevens. This is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay.
Sources and Methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.